Well, we come to some pretty heavy things this week, but before we go into anything heavy, I'm just going to do something goofy for a second. Many people have told me that this image creeped them out, and I kept using it over and over, and I told them, well, don't worry, it's not going to be shown in worship anymore. But I am a little brother at heart, and it has never gone away, so I like to do things that bother people, and so I've shown it again. But actually, there's a purpose to why I'm showing it, and that is that the reason why I use this image while we were going through the series preparing for the cross is because it is a little bit of a disturbing image. It is the face of the Man of Sorrows being made out of the scene of the crucifixion, of Jesus carrying his own cross, and Simon of Cyrene coming along to help him, and all the crowds around shouting, and it is a disturbing scene. And I wanted to have before us, as we prepared for what we would come to today, the knowledge and the recognition that this is a disturbing scene. It isn't something that should make us smile and dance around with glee. It is not something that makes us feel all warm inside. This is something that should disturb us. It disturbed the people of the first century and the second century and the third century who were there while crucifixions were still going on in the public sphere. It was a disturbing act. And so as we look at what Jesus went through today, just remember that I do things intentionally, and I wasn't disturbing you just because of it's fun to me, although there might have been a little bit of that in there. The crucifixion of Jesus was something that on a global scene, on a historical scene, should have been insignificant. It should have been nothing. I mean, it's theorized that the Romans crucified tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people during their reign, that any time there was a criminal that they wanted to get rid of, or they wanted to make example of, or there was an insurrection that happened of one of the provinces that they had taken over, they would take people and they would crucify them. Sometimes many hundreds of people being crucified all along roadways intentionally to show this is what happens when you cross the Roman Empire. It was an incredibly dehumanizing, degrading, and terrible way to die. And we don't recognize that because we've never seen it. In fact, we live in such a polite society that we struggle in our own societal conscience over whether or not even putting somebody to sleep peacefully is something we should be doing morally. We struggle with the idea of the state even executing criminals who may or may not deserve it. And so we struggle with this today, and we don't really get or grasp the idea of what the crucifix really was in their day, what it symbolized. If we had somebody from the first century come and visit our church, and they were to look up and see in the middle of our church the sign that all of us hold so dearly, and the sign that you guys all love so much, we embroider on all of our vestments and whatnot, and they would look at that and say, what kind of people is this? That they put an image of death, of destruction, of dehumanization in the middle of their worship space. These people must worship the devil. That's probably what they would think. And yet, God saw it fit to use this device, to use this time, to use this kind of public torture, to make this symbol a symbol not of death and destruction and dehumanization, but instead a symbol of hope, a symbol of grace, a symbol of peace to many in the times that would come after it. What an amazing picture and amazing thought of God's intention for us that this very thing that humans would devise to destroy what God created, God used to restore what he created to be beautiful again. What a great image of how my own life fits into it. How I regularly screw up, how I regularly do things I shouldn't do, how I regularly knowingly sin, and yet God has chosen to take me, to restore me, and to make my life meaningful and beautiful in his kingdom for some purpose. We all can say something similar about our own lives. And so this horrible, disgusting act that only could be thought of as barbaric, right? Ironic that the Romans, who coined the term barbaric as those people out there that we don't understand, the Romans, the civilized ones, were doing something that we see as so barbaric today, that this sign of barbarism would be used for God's glory. Amazing, amazing thought process. And yet, when we come to Jesus' crucifixion, we're given very, very little details. I mean, we just spent like the last 4 or 5 months, do you guys realize this? Literally on like the last week of Jesus' life, going through the Gospel of John. I mean, we spent the last 4 or 5 months looking through several chapters of the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John's only like 21 chapters long, and we just spent 4 or 5 months going through about 7, 8, 9, 10 chapters, something like that. So like half of the entire gospel, and it was all dedicated to 1 week of Jesus' life. And yet we come to what we sometimes idolize and we look at as being one of the most important things in our faith, and John's words are like that big on a page about the crucifixion. And the other gospel writers are similar. They don't give very many details. They don't really talk much about what happened during the crucifixion. If we were to make this into a movie today, we might spend great lengths going through all the torture and all the suffering that Jesus went through to build up the drama and to show and depict and pull on the heartstrings and emotions of the viewers to get and understand how terrible this act was. And yet the gospel writers spend, oh, there was somebody who did that, right? That's right. There was a movie about that. But the gospel writers spend just a couple of paragraphs each just glossing by it. It doesn't seem to be significant to their theology. It doesn't seem to be something that they seem to want to dwell on or think about. Now, there's several different reasons for this. For one thing, the crucifixion was something that everybody in their day, as they were writing to their audiences, would understand immediately, right? They saw it. Many, many people would have seen, most people would have seen in some play, some kind of public display of this kind of execution in their lives. It was just a part of living in the Roman world. And so they would have understood, and if they hadn't seen it themselves, they had had it described to them in such a way that they knew you don't want to get on the bad side of the Roman Empire because you don't want to end up on one of these crosses. And so they knew how terrible it was. So the writers didn't need to go into detail because all they needed to say was one word. Jesus was crucified. One word, crucified. And they knew automatically all those images flooded into their brain, all those emotions that they held with it flooded into their heart and their soul. There wasn't need for much more elaboration. But I think there's another significance to this, that the fact that they don't focus on it. And that is because even in the midst of this crucifixion, even in the details we are given, the things that we see as so terrible and suffering in Jesus Christ are constantly kind of counteracted with an inhuman, divine joy in what he's accomplishing. In other words, as the Romans are trying to beat him down and strip him of his humanity, God is superhumanly making him more human in the midst of his suffering and counteracting the very thing the Romans, and by extension all of us, are trying to do. The end result of sin, which is to destroy God's creation, to break it down and make it meaningless and make it nothing, God, in the midst of the very act of that, turns it on its head and makes it the most meaningful thing and makes it victory even in the face of defeat. What an amazing image. What an amazing picture. So let's walk through and let's look at these things. Jesus was hung on a cross, and it says in this passage that Pilate posted a note above his head. Now, this was common. Many people would have a note posted above their head depicting what they did, what was the accusation against them, so that others who might see these crucifixions as they were walking by and in horror looking upon them, that they might look and see what this person did that got them on the cross. And they might say, I better make sure I don't become a robber or an insurrectionist or whatever else. And Pilate chose to write on this, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And he put it into three different languages to make sure that anybody who happened to be coming to Jerusalem in those days for the Passover or happened to be coming by for trade or whatever reason, that they could read this sign and they could see what it says. You guys understand what this means? Pilate was the first evangelist. Because the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ is that he's king. You see, the gospel, the word gospel in ancient days, in the Roman and the Greek Empire, was used for good news that the emperor has conquered his foes and is still on the throne as king. The gospel, the term gospel in Greek was often used, euangelion means good news, was often used at the birth of a new king. And so it was something that was to proclaim that the king who sits on the throne is sovereign, and whatever threat that you might perceive being against this one who is sovereign is false because this king has conquered over that. So Pilate, unwittingly, before Jesus even finishes his act, tells everybody what the gospel message is right on the cross. Here's Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Might as well say, King of everybody, right? Because that'd be the real gospel. So here's kind of this funny image right off the bat that God shows right off the bat that he's going to conquer sin and death in this horrible, terrible act. That he's flipping it all on its head right in this. And of course, the Jews of the day, as they began to hear the people and gathering and seeing that and questioning, what is this? They're crucifying the king? They're crucifying the king of the Jews? We didn't know that this man was king. What's going on? They went to him and they said, can you please put a little addendum on there? Can you just change it? So it says, he claimed to be the king of the Jews. And Pilate kind of mockingly says, I have written what I have written, right? He's been in conflict with these people, and these people have been forcing him to do something he hasn't seen a need to do, but he doesn't really care. Human life doesn't mean anything to him. And so he's mocking them by naming this person King of the Jews. And again, he's reminding the Jewish people who's in power here, right? The Romans. This is what happens when any of you people claim to be king. We'll take you at your word and we'll crucify you. But in that very act, God already begins to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ, which is that Jesus is victorious, that he is the king, and his sovereignty is not threatened, and that he is in control, even here on the cross. We see this. We see that the soldiers, the four soldiers, we know there's four because they've divided his garments into four pieces so that each soldier would get a piece. This was also something that was customary. It was kind of a little bit of a perk of the job of being one of the executioner's guard, being one of these who would do this horrific, inhumane act. They were able to take the possessions of the one that they were killing, and they were to keep them for themselves, gain some little bit of value from this person's tragic end. So they split Jesus' clothes up, but there was one piece of cloth, his undergarment, that was so well sewn together. Olympia, are you here? Because you would appreciate that. She's up north. Well, she missed my call out to her, my shout out to her. She would appreciate that this piece of cloth was so well woven together. It wasn't stitched together from smaller fragments. It was worth a lot of money. It would have been worth a good amount. And so they chose not to divide that, not to rip it into four, but instead they cast lots for it. So this more dehumanization where his possessions, his very few possessions, his very few things of material worth are being stripped from him, and the guards are just kind of, you know, sloughing him off, and they're taking it for themselves and going and using it for whatever they see fit. Right in the midst of that, what does John do? John reminds us what? There's a psalm about this. God knew about this beforehand. God prophesied this, that my clothes would be divided among them and they would cast lots for my clothes. And so right in the face of this dehumanization, right in the face of this depressive act of Jesus losing his last material possessions, God reminds us that he knew this was going to happen and that he prophesied about it thousands of years before in the time of King David when he was writing down the Psalms. God knew this act was going to happen long before Jesus ever was on this earth. And so who's in control? Who's king? God's in control. God's king. And Jesus is sitting on the cross as king, not as some criminal. Let's walk further. We see that there's four women who stay with Jesus, right? Women, here's a time where you should stand up and you should say, see, this is why we're better than men. Because all the men disappeared from Jesus. We don't see any of them falling around except for one guy, and it's the guy who wrote this gospel. We'll talk about him in a second. But there's four women who are there. The devoted disciples of Jesus, the women in Jesus' life, follow him around, and they put themselves in danger to see his suffering, to see his pain. They're there with him at the cross. His mother's sister, and Mary, the mother of Cleopas, and Mary Magdalene. They're there. The four who are named, the four who are given some kind of image as being in support and being with Jesus during his darkest times, are women. Again, another thing that shouldn't happen in ancient literature. These women shouldn't be held up as examples of any kind of greatness or righteousness, and yet the women of the church have always been broken kind of the bounds of the ideas of patriarchal society. So these four women are with him. They're seeing his suffering. And Jesus, in the midst of that, turns to his beloved disciple, John, who's standing there with his mother, and he gives his mother to him to be cared for. What a more human thing can there be than that Jesus is caring about his mom as he's dying on the cross? All moms in here, does that make you tear up just a tiny bit? That your sons would love you that much that even if they were dying on the cross, that their last thoughts might be about your care and about you having a good life after they're gone, right? That's what we hope for as parents, especially, I think, as moms. And so here's Jesus on the cross, and one of his last concerns is about his mother's welfare. Now, why does he give Mary to John? There's all kinds of different thoughts on this. This is kind of part of the evidence that the Catholic Church uses to say that Mary didn't have any other children by Joseph, that Jesus was her one and only child with Joseph. And the brothers and sisters we see of Jesus's mentioned in the gospel are actually kind of half-brothers and sisters from a previous marriage of Joseph's. And so they're not actually blood-related to Jesus. And yet, the Protestant church has rejected this for years and believes that Mary went on and had many other kids and that these other kids were actually Mary's kids. So why would Jesus be giving his mom away to John and not to one of his brothers? Anybody have an answer to this? Bert, you have it. Yeah. Mary believed that Jesus was the Son of God and that Jesus was the Messiah, right? But we have no indication before the resurrection that any of Jesus' real physical brothers and sisters, blood brothers and sisters in this world, that they believed in him at all. In fact, all the indications we have from any mention of them in the Gospels is that they mocked him and they kind of resented him and didn't like that he called himself the Messiah or that he was presented as this Messiah. And they didn't believe in him. It wasn't until later that they became convinced that he was who he said he was. And so Jesus wanted Mary to be looked after by somebody who knew and understood the hope that he was presenting to the world in his own death. He wanted to make sure that Mary was going to be taken care of in the way that he was expecting Mary to be taken care of, and he trusted the only male disciple that we see named, or unnamed, or whatever, but is there present at the cross. And so he turns to John, and he asks John to take care of her. gives his mother to him to take care of. What a human act, though, in the midst of this dehumanization by the Roman government to try and tear his humanity apart from him, to make everybody look at him as nothing but a dirty animal, just nothing, no worth at all, just you might as well just put him up on a cross and skin him alive. That's fine. That's what they're trying to do to him. And in the midst of that, we see this touching moment in the Gospel of John where Jesus is thinking and concerned about his own mother. What a human act that he has here. He doesn't seem to be too concerned about himself being on the cross. Same thing goes a little bit later. We see in the other Gospels that when they try to offer him some drugged wine to help desensitize him and give a little bit of mercy to him on the cross, he says no. So he valiantly fights against not being able to fully experience the suffering that he was suffering on the cross. And yet at the very last moment in the Gospel of John, we see that he says, I'm thirsty. Well, why does he do this? Why does he say, I'm thirsty at this moment? Well, he wants to say something that everybody is going to hear. He wants to say something that everybody's going to hear, and you can imagine it. If you've been beaten like this, if you've been treated like this, and you've been put on the cross, you might not have the ability, you might have a dry palate, and you might not have the ability to speak loud enough for everybody to hear. So he literally is just kind of wanting to wet his whistle. What an amazing small detail, but an important detail. It shows his humanity. It shows his physicality. It shows that he's real, and it shows that he's in control despite all that appears around him. And so they give him this thing to drink on the end of a stick of some sort, and they allow him to drink of it, and then immediately after that, he yells out, what? It is finished. It is finished. Does that sound like the cry of somebody who's been defeated to you? No. No, not at all. That does not sound like the cry of someone who's desperate, of somebody who's been defeated, of somebody who's been broken down. This is the cry of a victorious king. It is completed. It is finished. I am done with doing what I came here to do. And he wanted all there to hear this loud cry of victory before he gave himself up to die. Notice that next little passage there. He gave up his spirit. Something that's not used anywhere else. We don't ever say that even in our own modern day euphemisms or idioms about death. We don't use that. What do we say? Someone has passed away. Somebody has what? What other ways do we talk about death? Okay, cash in their chips, right? What else? What are some of the other things we use? Gone to be with the Lord, gone to go home, passed on, right? We use all these different terms. All these things, to a certain degree, are things that are passive, right? That are things not that show that we're in control, but instead that death came upon us, right? That we had no choice in the matter. That if we would have chosen to, we would have probably wanted to stay alive at least a little bit longer to say a few more words. And yet here, Jesus is said to have given up his spirit. One who is in absolute control gives up his spirit. So Jesus is in control even here in his death. And then, in an amazing act, as the Romans were encouraged by the chief priests to go and break the legs, what a great merciful act, right, to break the legs horrifically of all those who were on the cross so that those people who were on the cross might die quicker because they wouldn't be able to hold themselves up and they would literally just suffocate to death because they wouldn't be able to get breath. And so they were going to break their legs with a mallet on the cross. If you're wincing, good. It's horrible. This should not happen. No human being should ever do something like this to another human being. And yet, notice the motives of the chief priest. What is the motives of the chief priest? To get rid of this troublemaker, sure. Well, also, that they didn't want these bodies, these dead people, to be hanging on the cross on the Sabbath, right? Because it would be a desecration to the land. And God said, you shall not desecrate your land. So they're following the law. Notice how hypocritically they're willing to cause more suffering to those people who are being crucified so that they might be following the letter of the law. Meanwhile, they have no concern that they have maybe defiled themselves by sending this innocent man to be killed in the first place. This great hypocrisy of the religious system of the day. Again, John showing us the contrast between where their hearts are, what they're doing, and their motives versus God's heart, God's motives in this whole thing. And so here's Jesus. And he's already dead. They come to him to break his legs, and they can't break his legs. And then John reminds us of another prophecy, another thing that is in Scripture, and it's specifically talking about the Paschal Lamb, that the Lamb that is slain in the Passover so that its blood would atone for the people, and its blood would be a symbol to God so that the angel of death would pass over the people of Israel in the original Passover, that this Lamb's bones were not to be broken. And so Jesus is being related to that very Paschal Lamb. He's been said by John right here in this passage, he's being said to be that very ultimate Paschal Lamb who is a sacrifice not just for Israel, but for all of humanity. And so they come to him, they find him dead. And so a Roman soldier making sure that he's dead to make sure that he's not just feigned or wooed or whatever other words people use today to say that Jesus didn't really die on the cross. They say, well, let's make sure, and they stick one of their spears into his side and pierce him to make sure that he's dead. And John tells us that blood and water comes out, blood and at least clear liquid comes out of his side, so they know that he's dead. At this point, John makes a little bit of an aside. John says, this testimony is true because it's the one who witnessed these things, referencing the beloved disciple who was there watching it, knows they are true and has testified that they are true. In other words, he's saying, I'm no secondhand witness on the stand here. I'm an eyewitness to these events. I saw them. I witnessed them. They were real events to me. Now, the funny thing is, I've theologized this a little bit, right? As we've been looking at this and we see that within this horrific event, God shows his victory before he accomplishes his victory. But at the same time, John really goes to great lengths to just try and state the facts of what happens. The other Gospels talk about earthquakes, people rising out of their graves, and all kinds of other mysterious and unbelievable phenomena that happen at Jesus' death. And John mentions none of it. None of it. Why? John has been theologizing for chapters and chapters and chapters. And when he gets to his death, he's stopped, and he wants to just present the facts because he wants it to be absolutely clear that this happened, that he saw it, and that it's real. And he states his purpose so that you would all believe in his account. He states all the rest of his testimony, all the rest of his gospel as to who Jesus is and what Jesus came to accomplish on the fact that he was there when he died and he was there when he rose. And so he's no secondhand storyteller. He's an eyewitness giving you the truth about what God has accomplished for you so that you would believe and would come to him as your Lord and Savior. In the midst of this horrific, horrific act, and think this week of the horrific act that happened in Las Vegas. What was going on in the mind of that shooter that he dehumanized people, a huge crowd of people, so much that he was able to shoot? It breaks our minds and it breaks our hearts because we can't imagine treating another human being like that. That kind of dehumanization, that kind of animalistic behavior. And yet this is what the Romans did as a part of their great civilization to keep any kind of insurrection in check. And this is what the Romans did to Jesus Christ. They treated him like an animal, like nothing. But God used that. God used that horrific event to bring about his glory on this earth, to bring about his beauty, and to make the very sign of destruction our sign of hope, our sign of peace, and our sign of forgiveness and grace, so that we might come before him and be his children once again.